Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We will start out with a public hearing on House Bill 2485. This is a bill that the House has already passed. Kyle's going to give us a presentation on what I would call the underlying bill. This is also the bill that we are going to use to make some final adjustments to the central assessment fix in an amendment. But before we get to that, let's go through the underlying part of this bill that was passed over by the House.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So, yes, House Bill 2485. It is a bill that was introduced on behalf of the Department of Revenue. It's much of it is really a housekeeping bill related to tax collection. What the measure will do is it clarifies that refunds made for correction on property taxes owed resulting from appeal is made to the individual who filed the appeal. It aligns time limitation for property tax refunds with time limitation for roll corrections, so that'd be 5 years. Authorized refund due to proration of taxes for destroyed or damaged property and clarifies the refund is made to the applicant of the proration. It will extend certain property tax rules currently applicable to manufactured structures to floating homes as well, and it increases the threshold for canceling delinquent property taxes from $5 to $10, which aligns with the current statute for refunds, which is also $10. And we do have the Department of Revenue here that they have some meeting materials. They can walk through a little bit of the background of the bill as well.
Okay. John Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I think Kyle did a very good summary. This is basically just a collection of concepts for housekeeping in the tax collection area, the property tax. And essentially, there's a consistent policy theme throughout the statutes on how certain things are done. But there are so many variations in how they're done that as these things are passed kind of piecemeal, they're linked they're not linked to the same solutions and the same policies. So this bill tries to link up, cut some things that seem to be left off or were not aligned. In the first section, page 2, lines 2 through 8, there's a discussion of to whom the refund is made. And in this is just simply refunds are typically made to the person who appeals a case. So if it's an appeal, it goes to the petitioner. And this particular one goes to says that the law says that it goes to the owner of record at the time. And there's reasons why the refund should go to the petitioner. Because ownership can change when an appeal is made or subsequent to an appeal being made. And so for all other situations, it goes to the petitioner. But in this case, for some reason, it was not. So this would align that with that policy that refunds go to the petitioner. Secondly, when someone's property burns, and this is a whole bunch of random circumstances here. So now we're talking about a situation where somebody's property burns. There's a provision in law for them to apply for a proration of tax. So if it burns halfway through the year, they can ask the tax collector to say, look, my property wasn't even there the whole year. Can you prorate my tax? And so the tax collector by law is allowed to do that. But that provision for the refund of that amount that's prorated does not link up to some of the refund provisions for other kinds of refunds, such as it fails to direct the refund to whom, to the person who requested the proration, for example. And it fails to link it to the minimum provision for refunds, which is $10. So it's just kind of aligning sort of small policy type things that have been decided to refund situations that were never linked to those provisions. And that you will find on page 2, lines 11 through 12. Thirdly, under current law, certain corrections to tax records can be made on an account for 5 years. That's what's called, we have a correction statute in 311, chapter 205. It says you can correct a mistake or an error back 5 years plus the current year. But when you look at the refund statute, it allows you to refund, but not for the same period of time. So you can actually correct someone's taxes, they're due a refund, but you can't issue the refund because the refund statute time frame and the correction statute time frame don't align. So this section, which is really contained, the language for which is contained on page 2, lines 13 through 17, aligns those two so that if someone is due a refund, the tax collector can actually issue it for the same period of time. So it expands by 6 months the period of time that the refund can be issued to allow the taxpayer to get that money. On the second page of my testimony, at the top, the next correction added here, which is found on page 2, line 45, just removes the word exemption. And this is talking about when refunding taxes, you can refund for certain types of things. For some reason, the word exemption was inserted in there, and it doesn't really make sense. The sentence says that the tax collector can refund for taxes paid on property value, a claim for exemption, or claim for cancellation of a property tax. It should say claim for exemption of a property tax. So that's just a correcting a word that doesn't really make any sense in that sentence. Then there's two areas here, and again, this is pretty random, where manufactured structures are treated one way, but floating homes are treated another way. And so if you've got, let's say you've got a stick-built home and a manufactured structure, and you've got a mortgage, and the mortgage and the tax statement would normally go to the mortgage company so that they can pay the tax because you've been paying into an escrow account. But for floating homes, it doesn't work that way. For some reason, there's no provision in law for the tax statement to go to the mortgagee, the mortgagor of a floating home. So this would allow that to happen so that if the floating home owner is paying into an escrow account with the mortgage company, that the statement could go to them. And also, just an aside, if you are paying into a mortgage, you're going to get a tax statement as the owner anyway. So this in this case, the tax collector sends two statements. So that would align that, and it also aligns it with the second point on that floating home manufacturer structure, is it allows it to refund provisions to apply to both for refunding that occurs as a result of manufacturer structure or floating home error correction. And finally, the law allows for a minimum refund to be $10, but the amount that can be canceled, if an amount is owed and it's $5, the tax collector can cancel that amount and not have to bill it or not have to collect it. But the tax collectors were asking if it's possible that we could get that to be 10 and 10 because it's so de minimis that it just is not worth them issuing, pursuing collection on somebody for $10. It still allows them to, but it doesn't require them to. So that's the sum and substance of the corrections. I think they're primarily housekeeping. The House Committee passed the bill. It passed the floor of the House on the consent calendar, 60-0. So I urge your support for this housekeeping bill for the tax collectors.
Thank you. Any questions on this, Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick clarification for the record to make sure. In terms of floating homes and manufactured homes, it really doesn't change the substance of taxation, assessment, so on and so forth. It's just these technical fixes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, that's correct.
Thank you.
Further questions on this part of the bill? Okay, and the amendments are not yours. The amendments came from trying to adjust the ghost of Senate Bill 611.
That's what I understand, sir.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
And we are trying to make those adjustments to the tax incentive on that tier of 611, and so we are working on that. We had the dash ones come out yesterday. The dash threes are still in draft form, but not quite ready to go. And thank you for working with us on looking over those.
Absolutely.
So we will wait until those get ready, which may be later today or tomorrow, and set this for a public hearing or work session on Tuesday.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2485. And we have some transportation talk coming up here, so let's move into an informational hearing on transportation. Mazen is here, and then we will go into a joint or simultaneous public hearing on Senate Bill 925, SJR 27, after this.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Morning.
Committee members, the transportation issues that you have today, I have some documents and all this. This is primarily a result of what we call a highway cost allocation study. This is in response and in answer to the requirement in the Constitution to look into the balance between the heavy and light vehicles and see if everybody pays proportionally to their costs. However, in addition to doing highway cost allocation all interim long and having a lot of fun with that, we do other things, and this is what we bring you today. So we bring you the results of the constitutional study and the highway cost allocation report, and then we do issue papers, and these issue papers are things that we ask the different experts to study in relation to transportation. And today, with this study, we're bringing you two of these, we think, very forward-looking issue papers. These are the efficient fee pilot white paper, and this is talks about how you could efficiently charge for transportation services in a different way than we are charging today, and the carbon tax interaction or the possibility of a carbon tax and its interaction with transportation and transportation issues. Now, the highway cost allocation study is done and in statute overseen by the Office of the State Economist. So Mark McMullen, the state economist, is here, and he brings with him some of the experts that looked into these issues, and also the members of the SRT, the study review team. Study review team is made up of different people who look into and guide the study in the interim. So they will come and start going through this these results and these processes with you, and he will be able to give you these different results and different papers and their forward-looking research.
Okay. Let's bring up that team.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm always nervous when the state economist comes.
The last few times I've been up here, it's been windy.
Yeah, I know, but it's that third or fourth time that comes. It's just not his fault either.
We're all economists today, so we'll make it extra special for you.
Thanks, Senator Haas, members of the committee. Thanks for having us today. As Mazen explained very well, we're here as part of our statutory duties around the highway cost allocation study that for almost 20 years now we've had in the Constitution, which requires us to report to this body every biennium to talk about whether the shares paid by light and heavy vehicles are fair in relationship to the amount of use they put on the roads. And so the upshot of that this round is that there was not a lot of change. The current rates we have in terms of gas tax and weight mile tax are very close to fair, given the system we're talking about, which is just the damage to the roads. Looks like they're very close to fair, and there's no need at the current time for legislative action to make these equitable. And if the legislature were to put together a more complete transportation package and repeg these rates today, they would be almost indistinguishable for cars and trucks going forward. There won't be any real significant changes going forward. But so the results this time in terms of the major study are somewhat dry, but that said, it is an interesting study for other folks. We're used to it now, but across the country and in terms of the National Department of Transportation, a lot of folks are looking to the Oregon Highway Cost Allocation Study as a model. We've done this a long time. I think the first study was in the 1930s or something here in Oregon, where we've tried to detail or dissect the responsibility for costs and who's paying it on our roads. Other states are just getting into this. Why? Because the writing's on the wall in terms of our transportation funding system. That, you know, it's broken and it's not going to, you know, it's not sustainable for the long run. So what states are starting to ask is, well, who's paying now and how would it look different if we went forward? Well, that's where we are now. We know we have a real good handle on who's paying now, and we're starting to think about what would the cost responsibility look like in different worlds if we were to go to some different transportation reforms. And that's really getting pushed by our study review team. We pulled together stakeholders, the bikes, the cars, the trucks, the counties, and the department, and academic experts, and to go with this study. And more they've been forward-looking. And it's really remarkable how much agreement there are across all of our stakeholders on this. You know, in terms of, obviously, people are worried about implementation and the different kind of reforms that are out there, but everybody agrees some sort of more efficient fee structure is the future. And so that's where they've been pointing with all of our discussion. And so today I'm going to have Dr. Negri talk a little bit about a general overview about the economic rationale for this and sort of a very high-level review of some of the reforms that you will be considering.
Thank you, Mark. My name is Don Negri. I'm a professor of economics across the street at Willamette University. I have served on five study review teams, including the most recent. The study review team reviews the contractor's analysis and is made up of a diverse set of stakeholders, including the state economist, interested citizens, independent experts, ODOT administrators and staff, academics like myself, and advocates from constituencies that have a significant stake in the outcome. The SRT scrutinizes every step of the process, including the model, model assumptions, the data, issue papers, and results. SRT members designate the issue papers, some of which you will hear today, and question the analysis and suggest alternative approaches. The contractor is responsive to the SRT's suggestions and recommendations, requests for information. The outcome of this broad-based scrutiny is a process that has integrity and an analysis and recommendations that I would characterize as objective.
So with that, this is Carl Batten with Echo Northwest. They are the contractor for this biennium study.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Carl Batten with Echo Northwest. And as Mark said, Oregon's been doing these studies since 1937. This is the 19th study so far. And since 1999, the state constitution has required a study every 2 years and adjustment of user fee rates if inequities are found. The question we ask when we look at these when we conduct these studies is, are the share of revenues paid by light and heavy vehicles fair and proportionate to their share of costs? And to answer that question, we calculate equity ratios. So for each weight class, for example, light vehicles or cars, we look at the share of all revenues that that weight class pays. We look at the share of all costs that that weight class impose. And we take the ratio of those shares. And if it's 1.0, that means there's perfect equity. If it's close to 1.0, that means we're doing a good job. And if it's somewhere farther away from 1.0, then the legislature needs to consider making changes to the user fee rates in order to bring it closer to equity. As you'll see in a minute, we're very close to 1.0. Oregon's approach to highway cost allocation is based on the approach developed in the 1997 Federal Highway Cost Allocation Study. The costs to allocate are the budget expenditures over the upcoming biennium. And the expenditure of federal funds by the state are included because to some extent the federal funds are interchangeable with state funds. For example, federal funds could be spent on a project that has a high level of responsibility by trucks, freeing up state funds to be spent on something with a high level of responsibility for cars, or vice versa. So we look at the totality of the expenditures by the state. We also include expenditures by local governments of state highway fund money. The state user fees are collected to fund both the state highway system and to provide money to counties and cities to fund their local systems. This local governments also spend federal and some of their own source money interchangeably with state money, so we include those funds, the expenditure of those funds as well. The local governments do have some sources of money, some of the SDC money and some of the property tax levies are dedicated to certain purposes and are not interchangeable with state user fees, so we don't include all of the local government expenditures. The results of the current study show that light vehicles are paying 99.74% of their share, and heavy vehicles are paying 100.47%. Within the that's well within the range of possible error from measurement and other uncertainties in conducting the study. And from that, we conclude that user fees don't need to be adjusted for equity in the upcoming biennium. And as Mark said, if there is a transportation package that changes user fees for other reasons, the tools developed during this study, the cost allocation model that Mazin has, allow legislative revenue staff to design those fees in a way that will perpetuate the equity we see now.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to step away, all except for Dr. Negri, and move on to a couple of these issue papers, the first of which is the Efficient Free Demonstration Project.
I have been asked to give a brief introduction to the two issue papers that were requested by the study review team. The Efficient Free Pilot Demonstration Project issue paper develops a roadmap for how Oregon might develop a demonstration program to transition from the current highway funding mechanisms to an efficient fee set of instruments. In principle, an efficient fee charges each vehicle for the cost it imposes for each mile it travels. Let me provide an economist's perspective for why Oregon should consider an efficient fee superior to the alternative, a superior alternative to the current unsustainable funding mechanism. The principles on which funding of Oregon roads are based is cost responsibility, fairness, and equity. Cost responsibility is the cornerstone of the biennial highway cost allocation study and means that road users should pay the costs that they impose on the system. Recent trends in vehicle fuel efficiency, reduced automobile travel, and alternative fuel vehicles jeopardizes the funding for Oregon roads and violates the principles on which Oregon finances its highway system. The combined impact of these trends severs the link between financial link between road use and road revenue. Funding Oregon roads using the current tax system is not sustainable, and while alternative fuel, hybrid, and high-efficiency vehicles are welcome contribution to greenhouse gas reduction, they don't pay their fair share of road taxes. So why consider an efficient fee? In short, because it saves money in that it uses existing infrastructure more efficiently, and because it is fair in that it is based upon the principles of cost responsibility. Not only is the current system developing inequity, it also does not account for system cost associated with increased use, that is, congestion. When a car or truck enters a congested road, it imposes a cost on all vehicles in the stream. Since the price of entering a crowded system is not conveyed to the driver of the vehicle, the price of entry is essentially zero, and the demand for road capacity exceeds the supply. The cost in lost time and delayed business deliveries is significant. How many hours have we all spent on the road in bumper-to-bumper traffic? And we pay for that lost time even if the congestion does not materialize. For example, uncertain about traffic conditions, I leave my house 30 minutes early to ensure that I make a flight at PDX. If there is congestion, I sit in traffic more confident that I will make my flight. If the traffic is light, I spend 30 minutes marveling at the new carpet at PDX. Either way, uncertainty associated with congestion has cost me a half hour for every airport trip. To give you some perspective, the magnitude of lost time last year, that one location handled 16 million passengers. Congestion also prompts the state to build capacity, while the revenues from the users of that capacity do not necessarily cover the expansion cost. Under the current system, part of the cost of expanded capacity may be borne by those who do not benefit or who live in other regions of the state. That is inconsistent with the principles of equity on which our road system is built. The efficient fee charges each vehicle for the cost it imposes for each mile it travels. Prices would be higher during peak times to encourage travelers to consider alternative routes or alternative times. Lower off-peak prices would encourage travelers to use the system when it's not congested. Thus, a well-designed and implement variable fee would use the existing resources more efficiently, reduce the need for expanded capacity, and give countless years of time back to Oregonians. In addition, a well-designed, efficient fee system would also more effectively guide investment in expanded capacity. By providing accurate price signals to users, congestion revenues will, over time, fund required capacity expansion. Those who benefit from the expanded capacity are the same travelers who pay for that capacity. Indeed, there are many significant challenges to overcome before an efficient fee system can technically and politically be implemented. Safeguarding privacy and effective technology to operate the system are two of the biggest hurdles, but a variable fee system is innovative, efficient, cost-saving, and fair, and worthy of continued study. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matthew Kitchen. I'm with EcoNorthwest. We authored the white paper on efficient fees, so we're just going to spend a few moments talking about what Dr. Negri really summarized quite well for us already, so I will be able to do this fairly quickly. The efficient fee, the notion of implementing an efficient fee has been something that the state of Oregon has considered for quite some time. It's been part of the cost allocation studies in the past in terms of implementing an alternative method to evaluating cost responsibility. And this was done most recently in the 2011 cost allocation study. The principles are the ones that Dr. Negri referenced, that each vehicle would be levied charges that respect the cost those vehicles impose on both infrastructure and the financing of that infrastructure. In principle, with an efficient fee in place, the entire notion of studying cost allocation or cost responsibility goes away, because those costs are so directly tied to the responsibility of costs the vehicle imposes that it obviates the need for doing the analysis in after the fact. What exactly is an efficient fee? An efficient fee really would have a set of components to it. The largest cost component in the system right now is going to really relate to the provision of infrastructure, the maintenance and provision of infrastructure. And so those costs have to reflect something particular about the vehicle and something particular about how the vehicle is using infrastructure. And so as you know from all of the work in the cost allocation studies in the past, certainly wear and tear on infrastructure is a major cost that changes with vehicle conditions, but also the congestibility of that infrastructure, which is the impetus for making expensive improvements in the capacity of the system, also varies by location, by time of day, by the type of vehicle that's utilizing that piece of infrastructure. And then there is, of course, an opportunity to think about whether there are other costs that vehicles impose, if that is a pollution cost, or certainly there may be a necessary component of a fee that simply covers the administrative responsibilities of managing the state's transportation infrastructure. So it's really an amalgam of components that can be brought together into one fee structure. So the opportunity is clearly to improve fairness further. We know, based on the results of the cost allocation study, that in the broad vehicle classes that are evaluated, the fairness seems to be quite good. An efficient fee would begin to look more closely at individual vehicle responsibilities. Of course, this is also a way to ensure that we're in a position to make investments when they're needed in the state's infrastructure. In particular, with an efficient fee, we would see that revenues would accrue over time, as opposed to that revenues would be something that would follow a particular tax structure or an investment package. And so, for example, once new capacity is added to the system, and congestion is alleviated, the fees may even decline because the costs that vehicles are imposing are actually lower after you've made improvements in the infrastructure. So this is a fairly different notion of how to finance transportation. And so one of the things that we wanted to do in this white paper was really look through some of the literature on who's attempted to think about how to implement these things, who's actually worked on implementation, and what are the set of consequences that we might expect, and what are the challenges in looking through designing a demonstration project that might help to further people's understanding of this this approach. If we move on one more. I had the pleasure of being involved in a study about a decade ago in the Seattle region where we actually implemented a demonstration of an efficient fee using a set of volunteer participants. It was a fairly comprehensive multi-year study, and as a result of the work that we did there, we're in a position to understand something broader about how an efficient fee might affect a number of conditions, how the system performs, but also just what are the economic consequences of more efficiently operating and financing the transportation system, in this case, in the greater Seattle area. The numbers from doing the economic analysis are pretty staggering. We have extremely large benefits to the users of the transportation system because we're able to manage the congestion on the infrastructure. And then the revenues are even larger. We see the opportunity is certainly there if you can move beyond the abstraction of what has not been fully demonstrated in an operating environment to the implementation of such an efficient fee, that there is real opportunity for gains in terms of travel time savings, benefits to the traveling public, especially if those revenues, which are an important part of that story, are put to some useful purpose. One of the other things that that happens when you apply fees directly on individual pieces of the transportation infrastructure based on how congested they might be is you end up with a very detailed picture of where the revenues are generated specifically in your network, and that gives you a pretty good indication of where you want to be potentially making new investments. If there are members of the traveling public who are willing to pay for a piece of infrastructure and that generates sufficient revenues to make improvements, then it's probably a good bet that that's a good place to make some investment in some improvement for those members of the public. So these are the kinds of advantages that we can imagine seeing from an implementation of an efficient fee. So our paper was really focused on what you might do if you were going to take the next step in designing and implementing a demonstration project, because clearly there's a lot about such a concept that is uncertain. There are, because of the way you would need to manage infrastructure, there are privacy issues potentially that people will be very concerned about in terms of knowing where vehicles are traveling. And there's a whole set of different questions about who's paying what, and what they're getting in response for the fees they're paying. Those are the kinds of questions that really need to be addressed, not abstractly, but in the context of really implementing some sort of demonstration, which involves human beings who have real complexities of their lives to deal with. And we certainly found that to be very illuminating in the Seattle area when we did this. Designing such a process clearly needs to involve a wide variety of stakeholders. The most congested parts of the state will have a unique interest in this, of course, and would need to be involved in that. And there's a fair amount of work that's happened already in a variety of areas in demonstrations. So designing a demonstration should be done with very specific purposes in mind. There should be a clear set of objectives to be met and real expectations about how the demonstration yields results that are useful to you. Some preliminary ideas about what is probably most important to discover. Clearly, addressing questions about privacy is something that is of paramount importance if this was to be a viable way to think about financing infrastructure in the future. Also the questions of fairness. Really, the technical side of this, how to implement such a system technically, is for the most part not a big concern. I mean, there's lots of technology that's out there that is proven and is reliable. And it's really more of the important questions about fairness and privacy that would be the best areas to focus and learn something about an implementation. I think we're there.
Good morning. Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. Welcome to the world of transportation coneheads. However, we think it's really important that you are aware that there is somebody thinking about the future of transportation finance. Certainly, we can't go on the way we are today, as Dr. Negre said, with higher mileage vehicles. Switching to electric vehicles, our current pricing system certainly doesn't capture the costs, nor does it provide the correct economic signals to the users. One of the things that I really like a lot about the efficient fee method is that the congestion fee, a portion of it is to pay for future increases in capacity. So it's much like a business that buys an asset and you depreciate that asset over time. And if you save the money from the depreciation, then you have the money to replace the asset. With the efficient fee, you're doing essentially the same thing with your transportation infrastructure, because people are paying for future capacity expansion as they go along. Another thing that is really important about the efficient fee is it maximizes the utilization of the infrastructure. Former Senator Starr, used to say, if you want me to solve congestion in the Portland area, not a problem. Give me a VMT or a toll system, and we can price congestion out of the system. And that, of course, is an extreme example. But what you can do with an efficient fee is, for example, you have a lot of folks that will jump on the freeway, and they will get off at the next exit or one close by. And they are adding to the congestion of that freeway, which basically is designed for the through traffic. those vehicles should be using the local streets to get where they need to go. When you price those appropriately, that sends the signal to the driver. If you stay on the local street, you're going to pay less. If you jump on the freeway, you're going to pay significantly more. So it balances the system through the efficient use of the pricing model, which I think is really important. You couple the efficient fee with the concept of least cost planning, and those of you that were around in 2009 might remember that part of the Jobs and Transportation Act was to ask ODOT to begin working on a least cost planning model. And the way that works is when you need to add capacity to the system, you determine what is the least cost method of doing it. So going back to my previous example, if you need new capacity for a freeway to reduce congestion, you may in fact increase the capacity of the local streets, which should be less expensive, and encourage people to use that are in fact making local trips, instead of jumping on the freeway. So right now, we're just talking about this. ODOT, as you know, is up to here implementing the latest VMT pilot, which is supposed to kick off on July 1st. So they really don't have the capacity to continue to begin developing something like the efficient fee method of pricing. But I suspect that we'll be back in 2017. And with the knowledge gained from the VMT pilot, which will be integral and very important to the efficient fee system, maybe we can start working on that and developing it for the future. So those are the things that I really like about it, and I really appreciate the opportunity that I've had in participating on the study review team. I've been working on cost allocation for over 30 years, which is just kind of an amazing thing to me. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, members, the efficient fee paper, there is two things on all of us. One is the efficient fee demonstration paper. That's the one that has the results. And then there's one that has an appendix, which about 74 pages of where the data and stuff comes from. So.
Oh. I was just going to make that same announcement. This is on all us. And it really is excellent work on all of these subjects. Cost allocation study, a title only nerds could love, but it really is an important thing that we refer to in the carbon tax and the white paper from Eco Northwest. They're long, voluminous, and they're very interesting. I'm from the Beaverton area, so I, like you, have become something of an expert on the issue of congestion, or at least a student in the category. Done quite a bit of research. And we could spend the rest of the day on this. We have two other bills to come up, but let's see if we have any questions first. I guess I would start off with Mr. Russell that, you know, this VMT issue 10 or 12 years ago when we first started talking about it and looking at studies,
right.
it was a non-starter. It was taboo for a lot of people because of privacy concerns, but technology has advanced so much so that anybody with a smartphone and, you know, cookies on your computer, is that still an issue? Are we to the point where maybe we could trade in the gas tax for a chip in our car so we can more easily price in congestion?
Well, certainly I think that the upcoming pilot, which will be the second pilot that ODOT has conducted, will help the public understand the issues. I sort of sit back and giggle about a lot of this. Back in the early 80s, the government decided they wanted to put transponders on trucks, and the inducement was that we could bypass weigh stations. When we first started that, and of course we started it as a pilot and it was voluntary and all of that kind of stuff, the drivers were just, we were invading their privacy. They didn't want people knowing if they went to visit their girlfriend or what they were doing and all that kind of stuff. Today, you couldn't take those transponders away from us. There is total 100% acceptance of the technology and what it does. So I think that it will happen, just like it did with us with the transponders, that folks will get used to the BMT tax and the technology that it takes to use it, but it's going to take some time. And it is just giving them the experience of what it does and what it can do for them. If just think, if you didn't have to sit in congestion, what a miracle that would be. If using the technology as a tool to get to that point, and if people understood that, then I think that you would begin to get acceptance. It's very important to sell the benefits of what we're doing.
Senator Brooks?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, and then afterwards two points. And Mr. Russell doesn't get to answer either question. So, from the Eco-Northwest point of view, can you just briefly, I mean, education's unsustainable, healthcare is unsustainable, heck, re-election's unsustainable. So the transportation's unsustainable is a great little thing to throw out there, but can you just spend a minute or so explaining why the present system is unsustainable? And then in addition to that, address the issue not only of fairness, but, you know, our infrastructure has bicycle lanes, pedestrian lanes, so on and so forth. So how do we take this holistic, how do we take all of this into perspective?
It's a great question. I think the current finance system, it may not be unsustainable in the short run, and who knows what the long run brings, right? So it may be a stretch to say that we know what sustainability is in terms of finance. What we do know, and this is proven true in my home state in Washington, although I keep saying this and it turns out not to be as true as I think it, as I originally think it is that what's difficult is building a political coalition that allows for investments to be made in the most congested places that are growing, that doesn't also then overtax the parts of the state that maybe don't need as much investment. Those are the kinds of things that are particularly challenging even in the short run. And so an efficient fee in principle can do away with, can change that political dynamic in such a way that people can pay, people who are burdening infrastructure can actually self-finance that infrastructure. Now that there's a trade-offs there, of course, and I'm not in the political environment to know how well that works. So that's a fundamental difference. And then I think there's the question of whether, you know, we will continue to be paying for infrastructure based on a tax on fuels. I think it's a legitimate question. It's a longer run question probably, but I think the most immediate one is the problem is this problem that there are places that need infrastructure and they need a way to find a way to sort of self-finance that infrastructure that's fair for everybody in a state in across a broad and very different set of communities in a state.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
And just observation, because we kind of need to move. As I point out, I mean, there's issues of, you know, bicycle lanes, especially in rural Oregon, where people are getting thumped because we don't have bicycle lanes, and there's a growing deal. How do you finance bicycle lanes and kind of in this model? In terms of the model and efficient fee demonstration, so on and so forth, given the executive branch, you know, spent money on the CRC, and I'm not dragging up the CRC, but it's okay, there's a way we can kind of move forward and figure out whether this is good. But I do want to dispel one notion, other than the ACLU and their lawyers and raising money and filing lawsuits. I mean, the whole issue of privacy really is non-existent. I mean, the public either knows or doesn't know, but the reality is between the Federalists, between cell tracking, between every vehicle now has the ability to tell us where it is anytime. The reality is the privacy of where your vehicle is going and where you're going is completely non-existent in the United States of America. The United States military through the NSA and other mechanisms, and unfortunately individuals who did or did not testify today or should have, we know where all this is at. The question is capturing the data. I mean, and the biggest thing I see in this is, you know, in the efficient system, it's not just been the problem with fuel taxes. My district, prime example, I have the Dundee bypass, where I have one third of the Dundee bypass, okay? The other two thirds isn't there, so it's not usable. 200 million $200 million project to nowhere, I guess. But what you have is you fill up your tank in King City or in downtown Portland, and then you come through my district to the beach and you come back. The tank of gas was filled up at the service station, you know, in downtown Portland, but the actual travel was the coast through my district and came back. And that's some of the things that, I mean, the technology exists, but if you're to do an efficient fee, you need to track where it's going. Because I think you'll find many cases, a lot of the rural roads in our deal, it's not necessarily the rural people use them because there's nobody out there. It's the people that are traveling through those areas and coming back and forth. So I would agree with you. The system we have right now, despite being fair and equitable and supposedly one-to-one or one-ever, isn't exactly going to work in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Berkshire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing I haven't heard in the conversation is the element of human behavior, which is completely unpredictable. I've had the luxury to travel many countries throughout the world, and I've been to some countries that have had these massive, beautiful highway systems that are tolled. And then right alongside of them, they have the old highway system that is untolled. And guess where all the traffic is? It's on the one that's not tolled. And there's nobody on the big, beautiful highway system that is tolled. And that's human behavior. And I think that that'll fluctuate depending on what's going on with the economy. But I haven't heard any discussion about that. You know, so I just kind of wonder about this concept.
Yeah, one of the prime reasons that we undertook the study we did in the central Puget Sound region about a decade ago was really we were interested in understanding how people responded to a different set of fees, and the only way to do that was to engage them in essentially a behavioral experiment, and that was the primary purpose. And there's been a lot of knowledge gained about that. I mean, of course, people are making, it's really inherently that trade-off between paying for something that has a higher value, or I mean, that's the trade-off that people are dealing with. And everybody does that differently. And so understanding that in your own environment is important to design in designing any kind of program. Yeah.
If I could for just a moment, I think one important point to make is that what you're example that you gave was a price and free. With the efficient fee system, and nothing would be free. It would be priced at different levels, and basically it would encourage the most efficient use of the infrastructure. So in your example, the people on the free highway with efficient fees would be paying a charge. It may be less than the charge for the freeway because the freeway allows them to save additional time. And it would balance it that way through the pricing.
Senator Riley, final question.
Thank you. Just a question and a comment. First of all, the comment on the privacy issue, it's true. We know that people could know where we've been in our cars right now, because we have a cell phone, I have a GPS in my car, but that data isn't necessarily retained, and the retention of data is what I think most of us are more concerned about. The question was about, you talked about the congestion pricing, and the example you used was not jumping on the freeway because it's more efficient or cheaper to do the city street, the local street. But clearly, sometimes the congestion is more on the side street than on the freeway. So in those cases, would you be taxed less to get on the freeway than on the city street? For instance, I live at the end of Lancaster, and I like a restaurant at the other end of Lancaster. I guarantee you that there's more congestion on Lancaster than on the freeway between the two at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the evening.
Yeah, in principle, the fees should reflect the actual conditions on the roadway. you know, the details of that get quite elaborate, and you have to, if for no other reason, that you have to eventually design a price or fee system that's sort of understandable to the to someone as they're, you know, make as they're planning their day, as they're moving through the system. So there's a limit to how much complexity you can introduce. You have to reduce things to some understandable framework.
Right. So you're going to, in that case, you're probably going to guide people down Lancaster, because, you know, it's more expensive to maintain the freeway, and that's going to take them a couple of hours now instead of 20 minutes.
You also have the concept of time of day pricing. So on the freeways, for example, during rush hour, it would be much more expensive to be on the freeway. During the middle of the night, it would be very much less expensive, or perhaps even free, because there is no congestion. So you would price the entire system that way to sort of balance it. And part of what you're doing is you're suggesting to people that maybe they travel at a different time of day to do what they want, get the 5:30 dinner reservation instead of the 7 o'clock.
Well, this is excellent work. I wish that every legislator in the building could read these studies, these white papers, two or three times. And if that happened, I think we would be moving forward on this. Thank you very much. Close that informational hearing.
Are we going to talk about?
And I would like to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 925 and SJR 27. Committee, this is here because of some of the work we've been doing in our tax reform work group. Some of the ideas that have floated to the surface out of that work group include sequestering capital gains proceeds into a stability fund. And probably second on the list is this issue, because the work group, if not concluded, then at least saw an opportunity to look into the property tax system to see if it could be straightened out or simplified. And, of course, any kind of change, just about any kind of change, is substantial in our property tax system requires a statewide vote. And so one of the ideas very loosely formed is to come up with a plan that offers a homestead exemption or a tax cut to homeowners, and then also makes some adjustments or some changes to the Measure 50 limits, because it's one thing to go to a statewide vote, Paul. It's another thing to actually pass that vote. Passing is better, I've discovered, after 14 years of politics.
We leave those questions to the elected officials.
So let's install your device driver software.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've got two very brief SMSs for you on the two bills. As the chair said, those are really designed to be vehicles for discussion around revenue reform. And I will go ahead and kind of walk through this with you very quickly, a number of the things you've seen, and we'll ask Mazin to do the move the slides. Just to briefly go through where we are in terms of the current revenue system, things that we've talked about a number of times, a quick review of kind of strengths and weaknesses, and then this spell out some of those issues that the chair mentioned in terms of what are these potential pieces in terms of revenue reform. These are things that the work group has discussed. So if you look the next slide, there's the familiar graph of the state tax system with the big red bar. And, of course, that's 70% reliance on the personal income tax is the highest percentage of any of the states. And if you look at the U.S. averages, general sales versus personal income tax, they're roughly equal. The income tax has been pulling ahead here. And that typically happens as we get further in an economic expansion. You see personal income taxes rising. We go into recession. We look at this number at 09-10, for example. Sales taxes were greater than income taxes because they're more stable over the course of the business cycle. If you look at the local system, the local system on the next one, you can see you've got that same kind of lack of diversification. Reliance on the property tax is actually 80%, but this is tax revenue. So local governments, and this would include school districts, cities, counties, school districts, are heavily dependent on transfers as well. So obviously transfers from the federal government, but also transfers from the state governments, especially school districts, for example. But if you look at just the taxes, the local system is overwhelmingly dependent on the property tax. That is true for the overall U.S. local system, not quite as much as you see in Oregon, as other local governments do have some reliance on general sales taxes and on personal income taxes, or local option sales taxes, for example, and more use of things like selective or excise taxes than does the Oregon system. Again, the Oregon system, it's overwhelmingly on the property tax. So if you look at the performance of those major taxes, again, you can see the personal income tax is pulling away. You'll notice in 2010, we had, for the first time since Measure 5 was implemented, the property tax and the personal income tax were about equal. And that's back to the point where the sharp drop in the personal income tax due to the Great Recession. Measure 50, system now under property taxes has created a very stable system. And you can see that the stability there throughout the Great Recession, some drop off as those assessed values began to catch up. We began to see a number of properties drop below its maximum assessed value, and its market value became its maximum assessed value in that case. So we're starting to see a little bit of a rebound. You saw this in our projections around the local property tax revenue for schools, and you're starting to see that up again. But of course, the growth rate of the property tax will continue to be limited by the growth in assessed value created by Measure 50. So, just a quick evaluation, kind of the state tax system. The biggest advantage, in my view, the strength of the personal income tax, is in terms of equity. And I mean that not in the sense that it's the fairest tax, but it's in terms of a policymaker, I think it's the most flexible in terms of reflecting your equity policies. It has the flexibility of a rate structure, the flexibility of deductions, of providing credits. So you have a lot of tools to work with within the personal income tax to try to achieve your equity goals. You can make it extremely progressive. You can make it a flat system. You can make it very broad-based, or you can narrow the base and encourage certain types of activities. The personal income tax is income elastic, and that means that it has it tends to grow faster than the overall economy over time. The income elasticity is greater than 1. So what that does for you as a policymaker, it means that as the economy grows over time, your revenue stream will grow at a slightly faster pace over time. That gives you the flexibility to invest in additional things or to adjust your rates so that it remains that same share of the economy.
Or save.
Or save would be for those times when it's not growing and during the recessions. And, of course, the advantage we have in terms of the personal income taxes is our the advantage of linking to the federal tax code. With the delegation from the Netherlands testified to the House Revenue Committee yesterday, and I think, you know, as I look at administrative costs, maybe it's not an advantage to be tied to the federal corporate tax system because of the problems they've created in terms of federal tax policy and the repatriation of profits. But you can see that those are the if you want to go back to the weaknesses, the biggest weakness that this committee you've talked about a lot is the instability, the high elasticity is the other side of growth in the long term. The economic distortions created by high marginal rates affect economic activity, both in terms of investment and in terms of labor markets. And then the Oregon system, in addition to some of exaggeration of the problems associated with personal income tax, just a lack of diversity means that you're focusing your efforts on a narrow base. There are activities, consumption activities, for example, that are not captured because you don't have a consumption base here in Oregon, a broad consumption base. So if you look at the local tax system, you saw the stability. And the other thing we've seen is there is a large amount of voter acceptance around the Measure 50 assessed value limits. People have some confidence, certainty in that. And this was a very conscious decision that was made during the Measure 50, which replaced Measure 47, was a recognition that you're going to lose some things in terms of flexibility, but voters are not going to have, in most cases, are not going to have big jumps in their property tax bills from year to year, which was what the driving force behind Measure 50 was. The drawbacks of that are the rigidity within the system. You see this in terms of the flexibility of assessors, for example, to even be able to respond to legitimate concerns people have about values. Their values were not calculated properly. There's very little ability to adjust the system in individual cases or for individual districts to go outside their permanent rate, for example. The system is not responsive to economic growth, and you see this, and this, I think, is very much a part of the discussion around the discussion yesterday with gain share and the SIP. In a county with experience in economic growth, would anticipate to see a lot of property value increases that are indirectly associated with that project. So if you get growth coming into the state, you see your market value of your property in that local area increasing. Of course, the local governments are able to capture that growth. Under Measure 50, you don't capture that. In fact, that was one of the major arguments behind gain share in 2007. We've also identified and done a lot of work around the notion of horizontal inequities. And horizontal inequities basically mean you're not treating equals equally. So you have people that have equally valued homes in the same neighborhood that are paying a lot different taxes because of their assessment ratios differ a lot. And that can be just due under Measure 50, primarily due to timing. So if you happen to your value growth happened to occur after the Measure 50 rates were set in place or assessed values were set in place, then you can have a low assessment ratio. Lack of diversity is another issue on the local side. We've seen this as kind of typical of the local system in general. Local governments have been kind of left with the property tax. The state and federal government have gone to the other sources. So here's the major pieces around revenue reform. Strengthen the reserve fund policy. You've had discussions around that. The system identified for instability. You know it's going to come. We know that we don't know when they occur, but we know the business cycles are here, and we know that they're becoming increasingly more pronounced, and we know that the income tax system is becoming more elastic and more responsive and more volatile. So there are options around that. You've also had discussions about the connection point to the federal income tax code, which, of course, is a state decision, and to review that and see if there's a way to connect that might give you more flexibility yet still give you some of the advantages of linking to the federal administrative structure. Consumption tax options, of course, we're one of the five states that doesn't have a retail sales tax, but there's also other consumption options out there. And then property tax reform, are there ways to reform the system that can gain some benefits, correct some of the weaknesses we have now without damaging the advantages you have. Reserve fund policy has tended to revolve around the 2% kicker discussion. That doesn't have to be part of it, but it does tend to be part of it because of the fact that we've tended to return kicker credits now, or in the past kicker checks, just as we're going into recession, and it exacerbates the effect of the decline. We've talked about volatile revenue sources, trying to capture things like capital gains, for example, and try to set aside a portion of those gains during the good times. We have proposals to mandatory set aside a part of the budget. We heard a House bill this week, House Bill 2961, that was proposed last session as well, Representative Bart and Representative Buckley, that what it does is it sets aside a portion of the budget depending on the state's unemployment rate. So you have those kinds of options that have been discussed. And finally, there are states, and I know Kansas does this just from the research, is that the limit, the percentage of revenue forecast can be appropriated. Now, we try to, the co-chairs always come up with a with an ending balance projection, but Kansas, for example, has a constitutional requirement that you can only appropriate a certain percentage of the projection.
What amounts are they at?
I believe that Kansas is 93%. And, of course, what the way the, that that ending balance, that projected ending balance, is your first line of defense. Because if the revenue forecast goes down, you don't have to come into special session or anything. It's like a contingency. It automatically is going to go down if the forecast goes down. So here's the issues you've talked about around rebasing the federal connection point. Basically, to connect to the federal AGI before deductions, the exclusions would remain in the system. That's about $6.6 billion in your 15-17 tax expenditure report. If you eliminated the federal deductions, in other words, the Schedule A predominantly would not be passed through, you'd have about $2.56 billion in additional revenue. Then the revenue gain could be allocated to either lower marginal tax rates. You looked at a flat rate of around 5.7. You could go with a larger standard deduction, which creates a zero bracket amount. Or you could look as in lieu of some of the items within Schedule A, you could set up a state structure that would emphasize things, for example, like home ownership, which you talked about. You could have a credit for a mortgage interest deduction, for example, rather than the federal deduction. So consumption tax options around a retail sales tax, the traditional U.S. retail sales tax. Remember that the traditional sales tax we see, there was a couple of states that introduced them in the 60s, none since that time, but the vast majority of retail sales taxes were set up in the 30s. And the economy was basically a goods-driven economy at that time, and they really haven't changed much. You could look at it, expanding it into retail, into the services, where you see the growth over time, make it a broader base and more stable. Another option around consumption taxes is the gross receipts tax, like we see in Washington, but other states as well, or a value-added tax, which we only see now in New Hampshire. Michigan used to have a value-added tax. New Hampshire now has what they call a BET, which is a business enterprise tax, which is based on value-added. Way we've tended to look at those value-added has been on an income basis, a sum-up basis, rather than the way the Europeans do it, where they do it through a invoice method. You take your total receipts and you subtract out your purchases from other suppliers to get to your value-added base. We do always spend time looking at these different bases. We basically estimate these through top-down calculations, scaling Oregon to other states. Our Washington is our convenient base. We have a lot of data on the Washington base. So we scale that to Oregon. We think a 1% rate, and of course these are, you know, up to 5 or 6%. These numbers would be pretty much proportional. A 1% rate would generate about $1.4 billion in 17-19. So a 5% rate would be about five times that, which would be around $7 billion. And if you look at the other ones, the retail sales tax base, what we do to calculate this, Washington also has a tax expenditure report, and they estimate the cost of these tax expenditures, so we add those back in and then scale them to Oregon. So that would be about $1.9 billion if we had an expanded service base, getting into a wide variety of services, even things like health services are included in that. And for gross receipts tax, we use the base for the CAT, which is the commercial activity tax that was established in Ohio in 2006. They have a 0.26% rate. I just used a 0.25. And because it's a very broad base, you can see even a 0.25% rate generates about $1.3 billion for 17-19. And then finally, a value-added base. This is really based on research that was done, particularly by Ernst & Young, on what the size of the base would be. And a 1% base, we think, would be about $1.4 billion using this income approach. So just briefly, some of the impacts we've had looking at consumption income tax combinations, where we cut the income tax and we set up a consumption tax. Generally, what you see is you get some positive economic feedback effects, some employment gains, investment is up, you have a higher price level. The downside of these kind of changes in terms of our modeling is you would shift the burden toward lower income households through a consumption tax. You could perhaps offset some of that, but the bottom line, if you put a consumption tax in place, you're going to make Oregon's distribution more like other states. And Oregon currently has, I wouldn't say one of the most progressive, but one of the least regressive of the states. I know Fred Thompson is here in the audience from Willamette University, and he studied this and looked specifically at how Oregon compares to other states. And we are really in the top group, if you're measured it by how close you are to a proportional system. We're very close to a proportional system because of our reliance on the income tax. SGR 27 is really designed as a discussion piece for you. It's obviously a huge overhaul of the system. It would repeal Measure 50 and maintain the Measure 5 limits. We plugged this in, I think, in those on the committee. I know Senator Hass was on the committee at the time. We're, I think, still remember an interim meeting we had up in Tigert, and Don McIntyre came to that meeting, and Don's argument was that Measure 50 has created a lot of complexity in the system, and his recommendation at that time was to repeal Measure 50, go to Measure 5, adjust the rates to reflect new conditions, the $10 and $5 limits. At that time, that was before the housing crash, so we were well below those 5 and 10 because of the Measure 50 effects. So, but that was the recommendation, to go back to Measure 5. And, of course, what you do under that system is you're going back to a market value-based system. You would get rid of those horizontal inequities we see in the current system, but you'd also lose a lot of the certainty that taxpayers have around their year-to-year values. The additional element here, as the chair mentioned, is to go to a homestead exemption for owner-occupied residential property, and this would provide a two-rate structure for individuals, so that you would have a portion of your value would be taxed in effect at a zero amount. So it would be like a zero bracket. Here's the effect of Measure 50. You can see the market value breaking away from the assessed value as Measure 50 comes in. You can see the crash in the housing market. The two moved a lot closer together. And now, hopefully, that line will continue to go up as market values, the housing market recovers. And you can see we're still quite a ways from the market value we were at in 2008. That's something we did not ever anticipate happening. Now, back to Don McIntyre's proposal about looking at those two rates, you can see that the Measure 5 rate is lower. The rate based on real market value was lower because real market value was higher. And, of course, during the housing boom, that ratio was getting further away. But now we saw it close during the housing bust, and it's going to start to separate again. So the greater the distance between market value and assessed value, then the lower that market value rate's going to be, because Measure 50 is going to constrain it. These are some homestead exemption numbers for you, just to look at for what we would estimate. This is based on assessed value, so it would be retaining the Measure 50 base. And you can see with a $50,000 homestead exemption statewide and the impact on local government and lost education, about $635 million per year with a $50,000 exemption. So if you're looking at this in terms of an overall package, one of the key things to do would be able to, you'd have to obviously look at ways to keep local governments whole. And if you enact something like this, is obviously a local revenue source, or at least that $349 million. And that could be done through a number of ways. One thing you could use to implement something like this would be the way we do the senior property tax deferral, where the state could pay that homestead exemption out of its general fund, if, of course, the state would have an additional revenue source to do that, presumably.
Well, we're pretty flush now.
Yes, that's right. So those kind of an overview of kind of the stuff we've been working on, and we would anticipate, if we follow the guidelines of Senate Bill 925, we would be working along those lines at your direction.
So, Paul, you're going to get us numbers on if we were to repeal Measure 50 and just keep the Measure 5 limits to where it would be something close to a wash to do the, you know, the McIntyre plan?
Yes, the McIntyre plan would be to raise the Measure 5 caps so that to make it revenue neutral. But here, what SJR 27 envisions is you could perhaps keep those caps the same, but make up the difference to the homestead exemption. So, because in effect, your effective tax rate based on market value now is lower, so you'd have a lot more properties below the Measure 5 cap. And now, of course, there would be a lot of difference over time too. You'd expect more growth under Measure 5.
The homeowner exemption would be pretty progressive, wouldn't it? That would give a greater tax cut to a less expensive home than to a $1 million mansion.
Well, in percentage terms, the homestead exemption works just like a standard deduction. So you'd have a zero amount. So if you had a $100,000 house and a $50,000 homestead exemption, you'd have 50% taxed at a zero rate. If you had a $500,000 house, you'd only have 10% at that zero rate. So yes, it would add an element of progressivity for the residential property. You typically see the group where you see the most regressivity on the residential side, there's kind of a J-shaped curve on how the residential effective tax rates are. And at that lower end where you tend to see a regressive structure is for senior citizens predominantly, because they have wealth, but they don't have a lot of current income. And if you're measuring it by current income, they may be homeowners, but their property taxes are a higher percentage of their income. There are other ways to deal with that issue, though, too. So,
Senator Boquist?
No, it's 3 minutes before we have to go. It's it's an interesting, I'm assuming we're going to come back to this, because I'm sure there's people that want to weigh in. I think one of the important parts is get people to weigh in. But I think the discussion is basically holistic and revenue neutral. How do we flatten the system? And unfortunately, whether you like it or not, it's the legislature that has to make that decision, because it's only the legislature that can do it as a package. The people can only do it one piece at a time. And I don't think any of us, minority, white, male, Caucasian individuals of this committee, have faith that there's only one piece and one piece only. So mm-hmm. It has to be a package. And the reality is, whether we like it or not, we have to talk about it and figure out what are our options forward.
I would note, too, Mr. Chair, that I hadn't really thought of this at the time, but I think it's true that SGR 27 is actually a revision, which means it would take a two-thirds vote to pass. So the council interpreted that because of the multiple changes in it as a revision.
40-20.
That's even a steeper hill.
Well, but Senator Boquist's point is right. It's just, we're the only ones who could put together that kind of a package, and if we don't do it, I'm not sure who does. Senator Edward?
I hear you.
it's tough.
Not one of the five of us like talking about it, but we must talk about it to figure out if you're going to reduce taxes someplace, you're going to level it, you're going to figure out how to make it a fairer system, then we have to have the discussion. Doesn't mean we end up any place. It just means the discussion has to be had and we get better educated, because at some point, as we just learned, whether you agree or disagree, education is unsustainable, transportation is unsustainable, healthcare is unsustainable. And so the question is even when you go in an ideal world, if you're the conservative fiscal right and you want to reduce, you still have to have some mechanism in which to make this thing work. Or if you're on the other side, which you want to increase, the reality is we need a system that it's flatter, fairer, more easy to deal with to figure out where we really are in the future. And so I don't know if we get there this year or not, Mr. Chair, but I'm more than willing to be tarred and feathered to have the discussion.
As am I. That's why I'm here.
Well, I can deal with teenage daughters. I can deal with this.
I'm assuming that, Mr. Chair, we're in the future, because I know there's people that want to talk about this.
We have some sign-ups.
And we're not going to have time, because we're off to the floor here momentarily.
Well, let's take a quick moment. We have some people who have signed up. I don't know if you still want to join in. I know, Matt, you came up from Beaverton. You want to weigh in here?
I'd be happy to, if you have time.
Yeah, I'll wait.
We've got 2 minutes.
I think Steve Frank would be very interested.
I see one other person in the back here.
Yeah, Steve Frank would be. Steve talks to me quite a bit about this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Matt Evans. I'm a resident of Raleigh Hills, Oregon. I'm here today representing the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. First, I want to thank the committee and the chairman for taking on these issues. They're important. They need to be discussed. Whether or not they're solved is something else entirely, but the discussion is a healthy, positive thing, and the other reforms you've taken under your wing and the technology area and then more general tax reform are something to be applauded. We understand the concerns over Measure 50. I think Paul discussed some of Don McIntyre's concerns, and of course he's the founder of the Taxpayer Association, and so we have our own concerns about what Measure 50 has done to the property tax system. Most importantly, we feel that property taxes are just too high in this state. We recently saw a study come out that talked about how this Oregon is not a good place for people to retire. We have the wealthiest generation in the history of this nation moving into retirement right now, and what we're telling them is, don't come here with your money. Our property taxes and other reasons to not come here are just too important for you. I think that the discussion earlier about, you know, the progressivity of property taxes, just because you own a $500,000 house is not like having a $500,000 income. You can own a $500,000 house and be living on $1,000 a month on a pension, because the market drives the value of your home. You can't take that and apply it to taxes. So very much appreciate the discussion. Paul's presentation, as always, was excellent, and we look forward to further discussion in this area. Thank you.
Thank you.
Be happy to take questions, but I know you're trying to run. So.
Thank you. Steve Frank.
I'm going to get as quick as I can.
I appreciate your patience. And
get one of those microphones.
Steve Frank, State in Oregon. Good morning, all. Building a sustainable fiscal foundation for Oregon, a plan proposed approximately 8 years ago in the legislature, with many aspects still relevant to today's unstable and unsustainable budget, as I saw on the PowerPoint, some of the same points. We've had severe recessions, strains on the budget due to initiatives passed by voters, a volatile revenue system, and this came from this building a sustainable fiscal foundation for Oregon. K-12 funding not keeping up with growth in students, and a kicker that means inadequate reserves. Income taxes are volatile, and personal income taxes are the most unstable. What will make it better are leaders who solve problems, legislators who work together, and politicians who can earn the public's trust. During my campaign 3 years ago for State Senate in District 9, and being taken into folks' homes and hearts, thousands of folks, I found an overwhelming majority of citizens in a very conservative district would be behind tax reform if they could trust their elected officials not to raise their taxes with an additional tax. And that's more or less referring to the consumption tax. This bipartisan group came up with a plan to lead Oregon into a more stable financial future. They believed we could stabilize our revenue system, reduce our tax burden, and reform government without destroying it. These comprehensive solutions for fiscal reform would reduce the total tax burden, use stable revenue sources, and save for the future. Tax reform would be the key target. It would create jobs, strengthen the economy, reduce taxes for Oregonians, increase and stabilize revenue, and utilize unreported taxable income. Lastly, reform the kicker. The basic structure of this tax reform package was to cut personal income tax by 39%, add economic growth incentives, cut property tax by 11%, give renter relief, and enact a sales tax at 5% with a net revenue increase of $1 billion. This is all there, black and white. To ensure trust, the Constitution would be amended to provide that rate increases could occur only by a public vote. Just to get off just for a second, I am an educator, I have a fourth grader, and this constant battle to have revenue, to have enough money to support our schools, I want to use the right word, is difficult to deal with. How's that? And you heard I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of people talking about this. You've been dealing with this forever. It's time to do something about it. Paul Warner is a genius, and I appreciate all the work you've done. It's remarkable, and I am
flattery will get you everywhere.
Yes, and I'm begging you. I get down on my knees and beg you. Let's do something to get more revenue coming in. I know the sales tax or the consumption tax is not necessarily progressive, but it can be worked with, and you have a genius to deal with these issues. Thanks for giving me this opportunity to present my strong desire to see tax reform enacted and hope for a more stable, sustainable fiscal foundation for Oregon. Anything I can do, you can get a hold of me. I'll do whatever needs to be done. Thanks. Have a great session, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you.
Okay.
Let me take you up on that and go door to door.
Have a great day.
About 2 million voters we have to turn around.
Well,
this won't be the last word on this subject, that's for sure. So thank you all for your patience. There is no Finance and Revenue Committee on Monday, so we will adjourn today until Tuesday.
You know, this is when I ask for a raise.
So do we change it? So do we change it?
You know, this is when I ask for a raise.